This is Betty Smith, March 18th, 1989. Soul Journey, Heroic Path of the Feminine. Tape 1 of 3.
It's a pleasure to be here, and it's actually my very first time in the state of Washington. And I'm very delighted with Seattle and Space Needle, and I'm very delighted with the sense of water. And there's something very spacious about the city. There's room to move around and that we don't have in Southern California in the same way. So I'm very happy to be here. I thought this morning in the hotel, in the lobby of the hotel, I saw a little girl, a small girl, maybe 4 years old, little blonde girl, sitting alone in a black chair, holding her teddy bear and then rearranging and holding it very close, continuing to hold her teddy bear. And it just struck me in that moment what a far cry it is to take the theme of the hero archetype. What a far cry it is from that stage in ourselves of needing to hug the teddy bear. Because there's nothing that makes us more autonomous, separated out, individual, than the hero archetype has done so historically through centuries. And I wonder if we haven't the child, if the need of that intimate animal companion, the space between that and the singular hero facing the world aspect, it's probably too great a space. We'll be thinking about that as we go. I think maybe we've come too far historically. And human nature gets very burdened and exhausted with carrying such an archetype. So that's kind of the background. That's not mainly what we're going to talk about this week. Talking about the hero archetype, but that will be in the background of approaching a Greek myth that shows a somewhat different kind of hero journey. Not the classical hero journey of Pericles, Odysseus, Perseus, Theseus, and all of those very admirable heroes who met the monster or the devourer or the alien force and vanquished it. As admirable as those are, it's a different kind of hero journey, and I think it's one the soul longs for. In fact, I think perhaps it is the soul journey. But we will see as we move through the material today and tomorrow. But I would like to say a few things about I will say something about the classical hero journey, and then distinguish that, just very briefly, the classical hero journey is, to describe it rather than to define it, is the summoning of an individual to a superhuman task, which is for the good of the collective, for an impersonal good, to summon the individual. And with the help, with the counsel and assistance, let make the word support instead, with the counsel and support of a god to carry it through.
Could you repeat that?
Yes, that I would describe the classical Greek hero journey as the summons to the individual to a superhuman task. And in that process, it will be for an impersonal good, impersonal, a collective good. All the people require it. And one will have the support and counsel of a god in order to accomplish it. Now, through the centuries, what has happened is we've come to the way it actually seems to function, I would call the cultural hero journey rather than the classical hero journey. The cultural hero journey has a little bit, I would say it a little differently. The cultural hero journey is a summons to the individual to address important tasks. Not necessarily superhuman, you see, but important tasks with full commitment and courage. And it says nothing about the, it doesn't have to be for the good of all people any longer. Even though the archetype has an impersonal pull in it, there's something, of course the archetype is always impersonal, but there's something that draws one towards the impersonal in the commitment. And there's nothing anymore about counsel and support of God. This is different in our cultural hero journey. And it has affected in our time, men and women alike. I don't think just men, as it did in the classical hero age. It's in our collective unconscious, and it's probably going to stay there for a time. God knows, I don't know. The thrust of this weekend is certainly not, to the extent that there's any thrust, is not to persuade us that we can absolutely substitute the feminine journey or the soul journey for the cultural hero journey. But it is to give priority to this soul journey, a feminine journey. Everything has to do with priority. I think the way the world works, and I'm just trying to be pragmatic, probably we're still going to be bound by a lot of cultural hero values, which have to do with attainment, which have to do with realization goals, setting and realizing goals, climbing to the top, excelling over others. Recognition by others that you did it well. You did good. Did it well. And then rewards. All of those go with the cultural journey. We have it in every business, in every company, in all kinds of institutions. We know. We all recognize this. One of the things that has... as I was thinking about the influence of this and how much exhaustion and burnout has happened among individuals because of this archetype pulling so powerfully on the individual. And especially with men, historically with men, but now it's happening with women too. Enormous. You can't do enough. You can't ever quite get there under the hero archetype. You can get recognition for steps on the way, but the archetype leaves you feeling you never can quite make it. And so it is stressful, and it creates a tension. It does have some high values in it, cultural values. But as I thought about this, it seemed to me that I began to experience the cultural hero journey, I'll just call it the hero journey, in the oddest places. Really in the oddest places. Are we going to need to add so much? Not sure there are musical chairs. The hero journey does not belong, and we're not always aware how it creeps in. And one wonders how the hero journey got into that place. One of these areas that it creeps in He was in a realm of close personal relationship. At least I think so. From time to time, one experiences it encroaching in that relationship, a close personal relationship. Whether it's marriage or the love relationship or some other close and important relationship, an individual is led to assess his or her partnership in terms of goals realized. What have I acquired in this many years in this relationship? What models have been served and what model is not served? What standards have been reached? The problem is that the hand of the hero archetype, which I believe is behind this, is too cold and too demanding and too oriented to the universal for a relationship. Especially that latter. It's too cold for personal relationship. It takes all the eros out. It's too cold and it's too demanding. And this has to do with scoring and scoring and assessing. Now, there is some of these are just the habits of our conscious side. There's a line here between conscious thinking about a relationship on the one hand, and on the other hand, a compulsive need to score and assess and to say it hasn't measured up, it hasn't measured out. Now, if the heart says it doesn't work, that's different in a relationship. I'm talking about that hero archetype, invading in a place that it does not quite belong, and particularly because it recognizes the universal aspects of things. What men ought to do, or what women ought to do, or what a love should realize, and it does not feel or give itself to the uniqueness of the individuals involved. And that is just that that's not what the hero journey is for. It's at a disadvantage in the personal relationship. And one other area I'd like to mention where I feel is one of those odd places that the cultural hero journey has insinuated itself is in the individual striving to find out who he is. Of who she is in the individual sphere. It's almost as if one doesn't pass as a woman until one has scored oneself on this latest article, this latest essay, or this latest book of what women should be, or a man should be, or can be. And again, one has to draw the line between conscious examination, pondering the facts, evaluation, which belongs in normal conscious procedure, with this kind of compulsive, demanding attitude that the hero journey puts into it. So this led me, in thinking about this, to wonder, is there no other that can satisfy our bumbling along humanness with all its longings, its desire for satisfaction in life, and depth of feeling experience. I ran across a statement in Kierkegaard, a Danish philosopher of the last century, that spoke to me somehow on this floor. And Kierkegaard said, "It is not good if one does not get time to live out one's life. For the shadow existence also demands its satisfaction." This was way before Jung. It's not good if one does not get time to live out one's life. So what is summoned by the hero journey, and still is in us, in our professional lives, in our occupations, in many ways in which we have to deal with the world, we must be careful that that doesn't, if that gets the priority, there will be a shadow life that's not lived, about a large portion of life not lived, especially in the feeling area and in what is natural, what is in human nature. Now, all that is before the beginning. Now I want to begin. I think you have to spit that up. I'd like to say something about the approach that that I have had the experience with in my seminars, and it has worked well for me. In fact, I have called it, in my private seminars, poiesis. Poiesis. The word poetry comes from it, but it's not. It doesn't really have to do with poetry. It simply means in Greek a making, a forming of an individual or unique structure of meaning. Poiesis. Something very individual. And a structure that holds meaning for the individual. But not a universal, not something agreed upon by consensus, but an individual making. And I like to think that within a seminar reflecting on a myth, as we're going to be these 2 days, that a very individual process is going on among members of the group. That we're not going to reach the same truths. I mean, there must be an individualizing existential aspect to it. So that what happens is within your experience, present experience, not just past experience, the myth moves and speaks in a given way. Myth is actually just like the skeleton, in a way. And especially when we have an ancient myth that has not been greatly written upon by the ancient writers. And so it depends on us to flesh it out with experience. So poiesis is an experience such as that. And it invites an inner participation. This brings up an image that's been very important to me from my earliest trip to Greece. I was quite struck by the fact that the presence of the Greek theater in all the sacred sites, or in most of the sacred sites, Epidaurus, Delphi, Dodona, name the important sacred site of the Acropolis, and you have a theater. And I wondered about that in the sacred site. I would have thought the first building they would have constructed would be an inn, because people would come a great distance, often on foot, by boat or on foot, to these sites. And, for example, from Athens to Delphi, even by bus, is 3.5 hours, and there weren't any buses. So, I mean, and by boat, still quite a trip. So where do people stay? Well, for years they had no inns. But the most crucial building was the theater, besides the temple. Of course, the temple was most crucial. And then came the theater. Maybe later, the stadium. At the theater, it was not used for public addresses. It was used for plays. Arkansas was used for plays. And the myths were played out in the theater. And you had, as I understand and feel it, it brought into present time the archetypal realm. The gods who are figures of myth, the heroes, the individuals who are figures of myth, this came alive again in mythological time, and what Eliade calls primordial time, or mythological time, which has no past or future. I mean, it holds all times simultaneously, right? Present, past, and future. And so the myths came alive. And the myths speak through the most fundamental language, which is images. All of our dreams are full of images and narrative, aren't we? It's really kind of unusual. You hang on to it if you get some important words in your dream, but always you have images and a tale, a little bit of a line of action. And myth also follows this basic language of the psyche. So it's a more direct communication than our ordinary language, verbal language. And this, what happened then in the theater and the experience of the myth, a very vital time and the vital movement of the archetype was brought alive. And this is the time that of healing or change. All crucial steps are made in primordial time. That is, I mean crucial for the psyche. You can take outer steps that don't coincide. But a crucial step on the part of the psyche is made in this indestructible kind of time. Theater suggests, and by the way, I'm not going to talk all day, but just a little bit here at the beginning. Theater suggests mimesis. Mimesis is a Greek word for, as many of you know, for acting. If you look it up in the dictionary, you get the word imitating. I don't like that so much because it suggests maybe something fraudulent, not quite true. Mimesis is to enter, I would say, an archetypal action, and to do it very consciously. This is totally different from being identified with an archetype, which is an unconscious thing. I mean, it's different from an unconscious identification. So if I hope that you may experience some of that today and tomorrow, an inward mimesis, to feel the movement of the myth. One has to claim the figures of the myth. One has to claim the encounter, or the possibility of encounter with the God that comes in the myth. And that is a kind of mimesis. It's a direct experience, but it's an inward one. The nearest thing I know in union experience to it is active imagination, a very vivid active imagination in which one feels the presence of the other. You have to get beyond just feeling the ego's voice. It's much easier to write monologue than it is, and to tell the gods and everybody else how you feel. And that has an importance too. But then to really hear and feel the sense of otherness in the voice that speaks back in active imagination is very close to this mimesis experience in myth. All ancient ritual contained mimesis. For example, when the initiates, the Mysti, set out from Athens to Eleusis to celebrate the great rites of Demeter every fall in September, it was a day-long walk, and every bit of that undertaking by man or woman was the taking on of Demeter. They became Demeter. Ritualistically, they became Demeter. Whether man or woman, they went crying out for the quarry that was lost. Where is my lost daughter? They went crying out the name of the quarry. They took their long sticks and pine branches and searched the bushes along the sacred way looking for the quarry. The quarry, the lost promise, the lost virginity of life, that which will open up life again. Whether man or woman, you had to suffer with Demeter throughout that long procession. He took on Demeter. That is a mimesis. Now, as modern people, I'm sure you, in your group, probably talked a lot about ritual and life, but most of us don't do as much outer ritual as the ancients did. But I think it's still very important to keep the inner mimesis, to be able to enter a story, a tale that contains a sound movement of the archetypes. The great myths contain a healing movement of the archetypes. So one takes on the story as one's own. As for taking on the god in a story, I just personally experience the archetype or the god figure in an encounter as it always feels to me like something other. It moves in an inner theater, but it always has some transcendent aspect. I don't know what your experience is. Now, the myth that we're really dealing with is the myth of Io. Io, the Io. You call her Io if you want to. The Greeks call her Io. And as in all myth, there are certain things it doesn't do for us. It doesn't hand us a model, a clear cut, conceptualized model of personality. It doesn't hand us a group of concepts. It doesn't even hand us firm conclusions. It's true that you can evolve your models and your concepts, but the myth is at a level of experience and still a living thing. As the psyche approaches it. Maybe not as the intellect approaches it, but as the psyche approaches it, it's still a living thing. So it opens doors and it speaks most if we experience an inner embodiment. And that's what's important. So when you're looking at the myth of Io, you need to claim Io, my Io, your Io. To speak of it, it's my Io. My encounter with the god who comes, who happens to be Zeus in this myth. This is my encounter with the god who comes. So this speaking is going to be very specific to me. It's my temple that's forsaken when the young priestess Io leaves behind the temple of Hera where she has served so faithfully and goes on her journey. It's one needs to feel that action of forsaking, that abandonment, that darkening of the temple behind her. So those things, that's part of the mimesis. It involves feeling, to put the word myth, feeling and sensing, and a kind of rooted thinking, and it involves reflection. There's something that the French existentialist Gabriel Marcel spoke about reflection that has always meant a great deal to me. Reflection to him was a way of life. And I like that. This is what he said in his, I think it's volume one of Mystery of Being. He said, it seems to me essential that we grasp the flat fact that reflection is still part of life, that it is one of the ways in which life manifests itself. Reflection is a way in which life manifests itself. More profoundly, reflection is one of life's ways of rising from one level to another. And this mode is recuperative. It recovers something. It makes something whole or sound again. What's it saying, recuperative in a sense? In two senses, perhaps. So there is reflection and contemplation. If when we work, we're going to be working with some questions. Try to receive the question into the silence, into your own silence, into your own mute place. A little bit like receiving a reflection of an image on water, on the surface of the water. And then see, then look at that image as it gets constellated for you, as it shimmers there in the water. This is very different from, you know, the top of the head or the glib way we learn to discuss and learn to verbalize. But it does introduce us to the old mode of contemplation. I do think it serves the archetypes well. Certainly serves myth well. And indeed it serves the arts well. Now, what we plan to do is go till about 11:15 and take a little break for about 20 minutes maybe. And then we come back and have at about 12:30 our lunch break, which will be a long break, as I understand it. So an idea of the day. And if it's possible, we would like, this is pulling a fast one on you, but for those of you who could go till 4 o'clock this afternoon, I don't know how many of you can, but we'd like to continue till 4. If many people have to leave at 3:30, then I will leave you. Summarize what I said the next morning in that last half an hour, for your benefit. What was said. I suddenly realized that I thought we needed a little more time. Now, and at the break, there are going to be some questions, or if not at this break, at least by noon. Some questions to chew on. The cow is a ruminating animal, and Io in her myth undergoes, as many of you know, the form of the cow. I want to read you the first part of the myth. We will have many more things by the end. We will have some summary things to say about the two different hero journeys, the cultural journey versus the feminine hero journey. But now we get the body of the story. This myth, like the myth of Psyche, I believe is one of the great myths of the feminine journey. Now, whether man or woman, this is our journey. This is not just the journey of a woman. whether man or woman, the man probably experiences this, you experience it differently, much more his soul journey. With the woman, to stay with the Jungian terms for a moment, it's probably experienced more as a self aspect, as the depths of her nature, and it's the journey that is taken by those sides. In general, I will simply call it the soul journey, but because I think women can use that relationship to the soul, to the self in the same manner as soul journey. Like the myth of Psyche, it contains the a god for a bridegroom. There are several Greek myths that have divine lovers, men, the divine gods as lovers, and a human woman. And always out of that match comes some emergence on earth. Something happens on earth. Something happens in reality, in a reality situation that is very beneficial. Those children of a god and a woman, or the inner woman, you want to say, that those children of the god and the inner woman produce extraordinary things on the face of the earth. Some of the great heroes had myths like that. I think it was an age for heroes, for classical heroes. Heracles was born in that manner. Theseus was born in that manner. Theseus' father was Poseidon. Heracles' father was Zeus. Perseus' father was Zeus. You can see this extraordinary thing. But it doesn't happen. Reality is not profoundly affected. You can also say it negatively. Reality is not profoundly affected. The earth is not changed unless there is an intersection between the God world and the human world. And that is what lies in these myths. Whether you call it the realm of the archetypes or the God world, I use the mythological term. I have written dialogues to express as my own way of mimesis and finding my way into myths. I have used dialogue. And so I want to share those because it has to do with my bringing it alive for me in present time, and I hope you'll get something from it. It has a bit of the poet's license in it, but it stays as close to the myth as we know it, but I mean it adds conversation, which we don't have in the ancient records. But I believe, I have a little defense of it, that you need the contemporary psyche to receive the old myth. You need the contemporary psyche. Otherwise, you're dealing with something antique and, oh, isn't that fascinating? Isn't that interesting? But to bring it to the ground of the psyche, you need the contemporary psyche. So I think that enters in, although I have tried to keep the context, the ancient context there. Otherwise, it would offend my sense. I don't know what. Now, Io lounged and played on the moist banks of the river Inachus. By the way, that was also the name of her father, the name of the river and her father. She plays on the banks of the river at the place where the river edged a very deep woods. And one day, a stranger of noble bearing came to where she was sitting on the bank and spoke to her, a man. "Greetings, daughter of Inachus. For a long time I've watched you, and do you know what it is that I've seen?" no stranger of wonderful countenance, what have you seen? I have seen that you are worthy of God love. Moreover, you are certain to make your lover happy. My lord, you do not know, apparently, that I am a priestess of Hera, and that such love as you speak of is forbidden to me. As for God love, I know nothing about it. So this desirable maiden is priestess of Hera. How she does take the choicest maidens for herself. Stranger, do you know that my goddess is queen of Hera? So is rumored, I guess. Queen indeed. But come, Io, out of the blazing sunlight into the deep woods where we can walk together. Come. Cannot a man know a woman best if they walk side by side? Oh, but I fear the wild beasts dwelling in the dark depths of woods. If a god is at your side, you will walk safely into this woods. And, dear Io, I am a god. You? Then why do you look only like a man? Well, I suppose that I am really ready to recognize. It could even be more difficult to find the threshold of a god's dwelling place. Come. Let's go to the shade of the old trees. And she says, a paradise unfolds about us. And they continue on their way, and there is conversation of exchange. And then when she learns that it is Zeus, which she does, this is Zeus, she cries out, you are too near, Lord Zeus, too near. He says, how else can a love proceed, I ask you? And she begins to run. She said, at a distance, have I not admired your divine image and honored you with offerings? At a distance, I was safe. A god gets tired of distance, he said. It's his bread and butter. Besides, you have withheld the important offering from me. What can it be? Yourself, dear Eva. For the worshipper, distance is a proper thing. This I know from my life in Hera's temple. There comes a time, he said, when distance is a turning of the back upon a sacred meeting. I'm afraid, and I do not understand. That hardly matters. When the gate of your life stands open to you, a gateway. Yes, Aphrodite smiles there, awaiting you. See how she extends two hands towards you. I do not see. What does she bring me then? I perceive in her right hand that love is there, and in her left hand is a pomegranate. Yes. There are the two hands of the great gods. And they continue to walk together. And then she is aware that a great cloud comes down over there. Perhaps it's always been there, but she suddenly is aware of the cloud. And she loses the voice, and she loses the beloved for a moment, and it seems to go away for the time. But again, Zeus comes, and each time he comes to visit her, he comes in the cloud. This is the one famous epiphanies of Zeus, comes to earth is as a cloud. And each time comes to the meadow. They walk in the woods for a while, but the great encounter, and when Kaihan comes to make love to her, it is in the meadow. It is in the meadow. he's come in California, he has come in California. Now, there are two extraordinary images here in the myth at this point. The cloud, Zeus as cloud, and the sense of the meadow. It seems that Io was wont to ramble in the meadow. This was her habit. She would do her duties at the temple, and then she would go to the meadow to wander or to ramble. And here she was alone, and this is the green world. I would just like to ask you, because I think it helps for us to get the qualities of things. Not try to just translate them into some hard coinage of psychology immediately, but get the feel, get the quality. What does a meadow suggest to you? Let your imagination wander in the meadow. This was her place to be free. What is it like? What's it like to the senses? What is it like to
It's a transforming place.
A transforming place.
Transforming from an open space.
You don't feel it as very open.
Yes,
you do
feel
it as open. Yes, you feel it as much more open than the temple where she stands. Yes, it's more spaciousness and openness. So,
I may see a lot of maybe wildflowers, wild grass, insects,
wildflowers. Lots of sunlight flooding in the meadow.
And the odor of the earth and the dry grass. And lots of odor. It's fertile. It's a very fertile place. Mm-hmm. You know, those descriptions of the flowers and the leaves. And somehow, in the openness, there's that the possibility of either the sun or the rain, something from above to come up to the earth.
Yeah.
Yes. And a lot of sunshine, there are basic moisture.
There's a wetness and moisture, too. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, I see it as different from the prairie in that it has a surroundings. It's a boundary. It
has boundaries. Yes. Usually a meadow has boundaries. Some boundaries. Even if it's a natural mountain meadow, it has its sense of limit. Yes. So it's not an unlimited, it's open but not unlimited. So, I think it's very important to experience it from the senses and the feeling and to feel its contrast with the routine or the daily duties in the temple, where, by the way, these duties would have been for a young priestess of Hera, very precise, well-prescribed, physical duties. They wouldn't be maybe spiritual in the sense that we think of the spiritual approach to the gods. They would be tending the images, keeping them clean, lighting, keeping the hearth fire going, the altar fires going, and chasing the birds out of the rafters of the temple and cleaning up after the birds, and a lot of housekeeping jobs for a young priestess, a Hera in the temple. And even though she must have been devoted to the goddess, her daily duties were very routine. So, see, you get the contrast between the meadow and the... I feel it's the reason we're lingering over this image is because you don't meet the god unless first, you go for a ramble in the meadow. You've got to find your meadow. It's an inner state. Sometimes we have to do something outer to get in touch with the inner state, but it is basically an open place, very green, moist, all things have been set here, a place where wildflowers burst into bloom. Nature expresses what she wishes. One's own nature expresses. I think the green place on the inner journey is very important. It's a place where things will happen because of its fertility. And also in the meadow, one knows what one wants. You know, much of the time we get out of touch with what we want. But in the meadow, one knows what one wants. One follows if one is rambling, if one isn't due over there at a certain time. One follows one's nose or the fragrance or the feeling of the moment. There's no one to be pleased except oneself. And this is an important condition. It's a natural place to be in touch with. And one has a basic relationship to one's nature again. So that seems very simple, very obvious, but it can't be overlooked in myth. All of the there is a very real sense in which all love is invisible, and yet one of the big problems of a myth like this, a story like this, is that here a human woman can't see her divine lover or can't find him again, that he is invisible, the problem of the invisible lover. I have to just read what I wrote here. I don't think I can summarize that otherwise. The best part of love is invisible. By nature, love is invisible. And yet we live in a time when there's very much emphasis on love as a kind of behavior. And so it's really difficult to expound this other view. There's emphasis upon presenting and expressing one's feelings of love. And as important as communication and gestures and physical acts are, it is also important to realize that they are expression of, while the reality of love is invisible. And of course in a myth like this, it becomes even much, much more emphasis on invisibility when it's a God love. One of the things that happens in the psyche myth. Do you remember what in the psyche myth? Do you remember what Eros required of Psyche when she first married him down in that lower realm? And I don't know whether she could not look upon him. She could not look upon him. And of course, that's been tossed about and interpreted so many different ways. But often we leave out the obvious implication of it, is that if you look Psyche, you're not going to be able to see him. That seems to be the most obvious implication, although it has others.
She did see him.
Great, later in the myth, indeed she does at the lamp. And maybe it's not fair to say that, but it's part of the paradox of myth to expose the invisible. So first it presents it as invisible, and then she looks upon the invisible God as visible. That's true.
And she loses him.
And then she loses him. She says something, doesn't it? In that myth also, you have a very green and idyllic place in which the love takes place, down in the lower kingdom. Ovid gives a great deal of space to that description of the wildflowers and the rivers flowing, and then the beauty of his palace, his dwelling place, the dwelling place of love. So that is, I mentioned Psyche's myth because it does seem to be clearly a parallel here. And in all of these myths of the divine lover, which is a soul, all of them are soul journey myths. So they refer to us, they're not just interesting. In all of them, there's the difficulty of naming the lover. And this is a tremendous problem or dilemma. How can you name the lover if it's a god? And many a young woman, the soul maiden, has lost herself in her relationship to her father particularly, and sometimes to the whole collective, because she cannot say, a god came and loved me, and that's why I'm changed. And that was true. I think one of the saddest stories is the story of Coronice, the mother of Asclepius, and beloved by Apollo. Remember? And she, when she found herself pregnant and growing larger every day, she took a mortal lover. And then when Apollo got the message from the black crow, from the white crow, when she turned black, saying, you know, Coronis, Coronice betrayed you. Like, Apollo came and brought Artemis with him, and just as the wedding is underway with the wedding procession, Artemis takes her arrow, shoots down Coronis, and she died. And Apollo delivers the unborn child to the subsequently. Actually, it's by that time there is the funeral pyre, and she is on her funeral pyre, in her wedding garments, on the funeral pyre, and the flames rush up, and Apollo reaches in and delivers the god of healing. Extraordinary sense of how afflicted the god of healing is, the god of that kind of profound change. But also, how difficult it is to carry the pregnancy from the god. That's the other. How difficult it is to carry a pregnancy from God. And it's on another level, you see. That's why you can't move. You can't walk in and say, I'm having Susan's child. You're loony. Or I'm having whoever's divine child. It's another level, and it's a level you can't drag out into the sunlight, into the collective life. So when Io has been loved by Zeus, and we've no idea how long his courtship and love was, but except that he came as a cloud and he loved her in the meadow, I leave you with the cloud to birth on. Then she's cast forth from the temple, or she cast herself forth. It doesn't matter how it happened. And at the myth at this point, as you said, it was a transforming meadow, to save her from the vengeance of Hera. She is transformed into a cow, into the heifer, which is a young cow who's never had a calf. Not the mother calf, but she is a pregnant cow, a pregnant heifer. And she's white, she's all white and very beautiful, and it is said that Zeus gives her that form to protect her. And so sends her forth over the hills, away from Argos, the city of Argos, which is the city of the bird, away from the temple, away from the tradition that has sheltered her so far as a young priestess. Extremely different life. No longer the contained meadow, but pasture after pasture after pasture into the unknown. So it is there is a Aphrodite does play a role here, but she's in the background. But she does play a role in all Eros love, which is the love of being in love, which is the love of being bound to something through attachment, through a golden kind of attachment. Eros love. Eros and Aphrodite are in the same household. And they are colleagues and conspirators, and in the Psyche myth, they're actually mother and son. They're usually not mother and son, but in any case, they produce this ecstatic realm, earth, a realm that's satisfying, that has to do with our nature. I feel that Aphrodite touches other aspects of our life besides the usual one of falling in love between two people. And it's very important that Aphrodite be present to any crucial undertaking, because without Eros love, the thing will not satisfy. Especially in the case of a woman, a man can be devoted to the logos in something, or he doesn't have to have Aphrodite as immediately or as universally as the woman does. But she still is. She's still needed by all of us. She's one of the primary goddesses, great Olympian goddesses. That desire really puts one in touch with one's nature in an important way. Desire opens one to possibility and the deepest longing. And persuasion is not manipulation, and it's not verbal with Aphrodite. Persuasion, which is pytho in Greek. Pytho is through her very presence, one is persuaded. One is won over. It is not verbal and it is not manipulative. That doesn't mean nothing manipulative ever happens in the area of love, but it's not, I don't think it's Aphrodite's positive side. And before we break, I think this dialogue is between Io and Aphrodite just before the transformation, before she leaves her maiden form, before she takes on the white heifer, before she undergoes the cow robe or the cow skin, which is a tremendous incubation for this journey. Io says, again, I find myself drawn to the meadow, this has been my meeting place for my beloved, but I cannot find him now. I must be here alone. And she follows a path and finally comes and climbs high up to a rocky ledge, very in front of a dark cave, a narrow rocky ledge, this the way my fantasy presented it. And a voice said, you have found a precarious hidden place. She said, once before I found this in my early priestess days when the training seemed harsh and I thought surely I could not go on. How homesick I was for my mother. And now, do you again long for your mother in this difficult time? I am not a child. The child must never die, the voice said. What? Have I not worked to leave childhood behind to arrive at the woman, she who serves Hera? Indeed, the child no longer needs you, yet the path to her fragrant dwelling place should not be lost. It is the place of the ever-flowing springs. If I give the child an inch, she will take a furlong. Think of her not as the child then, this uncontaminated one within you, bearer of the purest longing. Call her rather daughter. Let the daughter be, for she is the connection to the gods. My hidden daughter. Yes, that is more acceptable. Oh, lady, I am beginning to see now. The daughter calls forth the mother, so it is she who will lead me to the gods. Yes, the voice said, she has already, in fact, led you there. She has led you to me, Aphrodite. Welcome, daughter. Here on this narrow ledge of rock, I am alone with Aphrodite. You need not fear me. Only take care for your footing, for it is perilous here. The footing, yes. All hail, goddess. I should never have dreamed of encountering you in this place. We are in it together, you might say, Aphrodite said. But I wish you to know that I do not bring you the ordeal to come. I brought you Zeus. For it was I who pointed out to him the green meadow where you were wont to ramble. They talk a little bit about that. Goddess, may I speak to you of my love? It is hard knowing that I have loved the god as a cloud and nothing else. Aphrodite nodded thoughtfully. Aphrodite, a cloud has no body. It has no steady form to be fondly remembered and desired. It is full of the wind, and it is always moving, altering. One cannot grasp the cloud or hold to it. One feels so empty-handed. Yes, I know. The goddess was frowning. The desire for the beloved to be flesh is sometimes almost unendurable. Yes, you do understand. Here she lurched forward and Aphrodite reached out to steady her on the ledge. At the same time, Aphrodite said, the god lover at every moment is far more than flesh. That one is more enduring, more passion-filled, and more present to the mind of love itself. Yes, all these things came to me in my love, she said, like a procession of torchbearers. This is an old struggle, maiden. I have seen it many times before in the case of a woman loved by an immortal god. What is difficult to bear is this: the lover is invisible. And she says, I know how much you desire to see his face. She says, now, goddess, you do understand my nature. And what were you saying about the invisible lover? And Aphrodite said, if the god is invisible, you can have no face or form to possess. And that is why the cloud Zeus distresses you so much. It makes me feel not only lonely, but unclaimed. Ah, Zeus claims you. But what he does not respond to is your greed, I think. Greed. Do you call my unceasing devotion greed? And Aphrodite says, it is no small greed to insist on making the god yours alone, and that he be cut to human size and me. Oh, I fear I've committed a sin against Christ. Hubris, no less. She said, Aphrodite said, I've never been a judge of sin, finding that role far too joyless to engage in. But if you sin here, I can imagine that it is a sin that endears you to Zeus. In short, Zeus no doubt delights in your wishing to own him, even as you adore him unceasingly. She says that this love is taking root in you. Because you are human, you shall be altered by this love. You ask me if you shall be joyously free. Io, she who loves, is bound fast. Do not forget this. It is the nature of a god, however, to go free and undiminished. Ah, is this such bad news? I think not. Think, dear, what bondage is more ardently to be desired than love? There is none. That might have been something like the conversation there before her transformation. And I hope now in this time that what I would like to suggest is that
at this point, the group takes a mid-morning break. The second half of the morning session, then, is taken up with audience participation and discussion, not taped. Betty resumes then after lunch at approximately Revolution 120.
Threads. I found the statement that I was looking for before on not the Jung statement, however, on himeros, the word for desire, H-I-M-E-R-O-S.
Could you write down some
descriptions? Yeah, sure. Let's see how far I stretch. She is one of the lovely feminine presences in Mortal that accompanies Aphrodite, and the other one is Tycho. Persuasion. Persuasion and desire.
Right? And they're both feminine?
Both feminine, yes. Both feminine and accompany Aphrodite, where she's also accompanied by the graces quite often, and even sometimes by the hours, who represent the seasons. But I had a statement about Himeros. Himeros is always partly physical and sexual, but she has a broader ground. She lies close to illuminated imagination in us. That is, she lies, and therefore lies close to the capacity for life. And maybe for the capacity for life to dance. Maybe that's the way it should be said. Dance. Close to the capacity for life to dance. When one is living a life mostly given to usefulness or productivity, our Western God, Himeros can get lost. Or if one's reality is totally rational and orderly, leaving no room for the earth spirit. I believe Himeros is the exhilaration of the earth spirit. The exhilaration of the earth spirit. With its capacity for satisfaction and pleasure and... Beg your pardon? Well, they're immortals. And yes, I think so. Well, they're never Olympian goddesses. They never have a separate mythology. And yet they felt like more than abstractions to the ancient Greeks. And they were pictured from time to time as living presences. But at least they're immortal aspects. And so... Then there was a request for the quotation again from Kierkegaard. I don't know whether I can find it precisely. It's something to the effect that it's not good if you don't have time. If one does not have time to live out one's life. Did anybody get that? Because the shadow existence also requires its own. That's not precise, but that's the gist of it. The shadow existence also requires its share. That will probably have to do for now. All right. Archetypal pattern, or the god, or the mythology of the god. The OS is masculine in Greek. The IS, I'm not sure. I thought it was neuter, but I'm not sure. I can't seem to remember that.
Are you familiar with what we call the Book of Qualities?
Yes.
The Book of Qualities? You're describing these deity types that are reading mm-hmm. real.
Mm-hmm.
Qualities like creativity and anger, compassion, are described as people and having personalities.
I see. Uh-huh. No, I don't know that book. No, but that's... the imagination does personify things. That's our basic... that's our fundamental language, is a language of that personifies and makes images. Right. Thinking of the fact that now Io is a bride, she's the bride of Zeus, and the bride is really the initiatory form of the feminine, I believe. And to this day, it seems to carry over in our tradition, in our collective rituals. It's the high point of a young woman's life, the becoming a bride, that traditionally speaking. The bride gown, the bride ritual, the bridegroom is almost in the shadow compared to the importance laid on the bride. It is an initiatory form. It is a crossing of a threshold over which one never returns, regardless of what happens with the marriage. One never crosses back over that initiatory threshold. And archetypally, it is the maiden who is the bride. A year ago, in November, my husband and I were in South Italy, in the town of Paestum, P-A-E-S-T-U-M. In ancient times, it was called Posidonia, after Poseidon. And it was a Greek colony, like much of South Italy was part of Greece, was really colonized, you know, Greece in ancient times. It was a great center, not really of Poseidon. He must have had some worship there, but apparently it was a great center for the worship of Hera. And so they have misnamed, in excavating a major temple, they've called it the Temple of Poseidon, and it turns out it's the Temple of Hera now the scholars say. Well, and there are three temples to Hera there. We were there on a very impressive site and very well-preserved temples. We're there on a Sunday afternoon. And we're quite taken by surprise when two different bridal parties an hour apart came into this great flat site where the temples were, paid their admission and came in and argued at the gate who was going to get in without paying. Nobody was going to get in without paying. So, you know, half the wedding people were left outside, the guests. Just the wedding party came in. Bride in all her finery and the groom looking spiffy. And they came over to the main temple of Hera, and they set the bride up on this great pile of rock, and the photographer, professional photographer, began taking pictures. And then she was joined by her husband in some pose, and then in the temple itself, you're allowed to walk in those temples, those temple rooms, among the columns. But we watched, and we were interested. They obviously had just come from the wedding, and then here came another bride, and the same thing happened. Each time on this pile of rock, and we saw three different brides with their pictures made. And my husband said after the second one, he's always better oriented to sights than I am, he said, "You realize what that pile of stone is, don't you?" And I said, "No." He said, "That is the altar of Hera." He got out his map. That was the altar to Hera. And I was just astounded that brides in the 20th century were being offered to the bridal goddess, to the wedding goddess, on her altar. And we saw it, as I say, three times. And then I came along, I noticed a young man who seemed very knowledgeable, fairly young man, Italian, who spoke good English. He was an archaeologist. And I questioned him, and I said, "How is it? Is this a local tradition? Or how extensive is this tradition that they should have their picture made on the altar of Hera?" And he really wasn't aware that that's what had taken place. And he says, "Oh, I'm very sure they haven't the faintest idea that that has anything to do with Hera." He says, "They don't even think the temple belongs to Hera. It's called the Temple of Poseidon." And he said, "And even if they did, it would keep them away rather than bring them here." I mean, these are Christian weddings. He said, "I'm sure they have the faintest idea." Well, he being Italian and living not so far from there, I presume he knew what he was talking about. But it was interesting to me how the unconscious, or what would you call it? I don't know how to explain it, came through. That they were picking these as sacred spots to ritualize their marriage, connected to a great goddess of marriage and to the great pagan goddess of the whole area. I don't know why, I just got thinking about what an initiation the bride is. Every year, Hera took very good care of her own preparation for her marriage. She's remarried to Zeus every year, and in the sacred marriage ceremony. And she goes to her bath, her sacred bath, which is the spring I mentioned, Kanathos, and there renews her virginity and is ready again for her marriage to Zeus. What I think it's May, but there is some confusion because the month of the Heros Gamos, the marriage month, Gamelion, is not May. It's February. And because the Greeks were earlier an agricultural people, they married in the winter when they wouldn't have to take so much time off from the fields. But May, in general, seems to be Hera's month. And I believe that that particular sacred marriage rite was held in May. And it was also, that was been a very important rite at Argos, where our myth took place, the first part of our myth, the city of Argos, that region, and also on the island of Samos, where Hera is Sphinx. The bride, let me just say a few things about the bride. The bride is an essential part of the soul's myth, to take this form, to reach this threshold and to cross with the god, to cross over and to conceive by this divine aspect, makes it very, very important. The bride is the image of beginning. That's the way I would put it. The bride is the image of beginning, of the time of a creation of a new life. So Io is one of those maidens that has, soul maidens, having that awesome title of Bride of God. Because all of the gods have an aspect, bring some face of the divine in some way. The virgin herself, the maiden herself, you know, is a kind of unlived interior wholeness. That's and it, she has that in itself, in herself quality, completeness. That's why that's the most fertile stage that we have to pass through again and again and again. We have to be virgin. We have to pass through for a new beginning, that kind of openness, but that kind of relative wholeness where one is gathered together unto oneself and ready for life in a new way. She's a kind of untouched part of our being, a potentiality. Now, as she goes under... under the cow skin, she's darkened. I can imagine her feeling life is darkened. It's as if a cold hand has been laid upon her. She speaks of this to Zeus, at least in my imagination. She speaks to Zeus about this terrible happening of taking on the cow maiden. This is before the time where she leaves on the journey and feels totally abandoned. And I'm trying to find a line that might tell, yes, just this line from the dialogue. When he has made her, the cow maiden, he says, "Hear me, Io." He sighed deeply. "This touch from me, this transforming touch, this touch from me carries my love as deeply as did my first touch. It will be strange for you and difficult to bear. There, my dearly loved white heifer, Io, go to pasture in peace, screened from the vengeful eyes of Hera. and sadly he looks after the figure of Io as she climbs the path to the pasture. And when she reached the high path, she turned, looked back to where Zeus still stood, a look of infinite sorrow on his face. And then the beautiful cow lifted her throat to sky and mooed a long, doleful cry. The cow form is an animal shelter. The hide protects the animal from the environment. There's a certain toughness. Certain things cannot penetrate when one is under the cow hide. There's a quiet muffling of the noisy, excited human consciousness. It is a protective shield. And of course it's a shield against Hera's rage, because Hera, it will be very jealous of this love. The cow is a time not to be noble or high or admirable in others' eyes. It is not a time for physical achievement. It's not a time for goal realization. It does protect one from falling into a negative queen role. We'll have to think about that a little bit. The cow causes Io to live the most fundamental feminine, the very instinctual basis of what we mean when we speak of yin, the feminine aspect of being, total being, the yin. It's a receptive form of the feminine. It is generative. You spoke of the cow this morning. You expect something from the cow, nurturing and a calf and so forth. So it's a very generative form of the feminine. The cow is attracted to life and serves life. It's a rather egoless way of going, isn't it? At least that. And it's slow. It's tuned to life rhythm. It's tuned to nature's rhythm, a life rhythm. And it serves this nature and the life rhythm. There's nothing more regular than a cow giving her milk and so forth. For some years we raised goats when our children were growing up, and nobody told me in advance that there aren't any vacations for mother goats. And I mean, the milk comes twice a day, and regardless of what you have scheduled or where you'd like to go, twice a day the goats have to be milked. There's no complaint on the part of the goat unless you fail to milk them. And so the same with cows. It's a rhythm that's given by nature. Just a rhythm. So she is the in naturam, in nature. This is an in nature period of the inner process. And I think it's very important to the individuation process. It's a closeness to the instincts. It's a closeness to one's nature. And it's a kind of honoring. It's of infinite worth just to be a being in nature. The maiden is, not the cow. But she has this dual aspect. But yes, the maiden undoubtedly finds it very difficult to live this. Because there is some collision, isn't there, between the two worlds. It's not a woman's world, naturally. There is a wonderful statement in Egyptian writing made by the goddess Nut, in which she says, as I recall, something like this. She's thinking of her cow form. She said, "I am all that has been and all that is and all that shall be, and no one has ever uncovered my cow robe." My cow robe. That may not be precise, but she speaks of that as the great cow goddess. No one has ever uncovered my robe. Here, but that's what I remember. No one has ever uncovered it. Here it is. I thought maybe I had written it. I left out that last part. That no one has ever uncovered my robe. No one has ever come to see this particular mystery of feminine being. This generative feminine. They saw in it a great cosmic force with the power to bring into life. No. So. And Jung says, in regard to nature, which we're talking about, nature must not win the game. Nature must not win the game, but she cannot lose. What does that mean? Nature cannot win the game. She must not win the game, but she cannot lose. I think if we understood that, we'd understand it. Yes? We really are mortal.
We need to transcend our mortal selves, but we can't
do away with nature. We can't do away with, we can't deny our concrete selves. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But nature isn't all there is. But it certainly is. Cannot be overlooked, or it retaliates. It's that simple. You get a neurosis or you get sick if your nature is not, if it loses. Okay. To take on the cow, and I hope we can kind of individualize this for ourselves, is the underworld initiation of Io into the feminine source. This is her underworld initiation. When you see underworld in Greek mythology, you translate it unconscious. It's initiation to the unconscious. It's an initiation into the realm of Earth Goddess. When she leaves the cow, and she does in this myth, when she leaves the cow and returns to her human form, her conscious life, She will know the earth goddess as a root knows the ground it penetrates. And not only will her instinctual and feeling life be renewed, but she's going to possess in small measure some of the generative power of the great feminine. And it occurs to me that she will, you know, then mirror nature again. Mirror nature. It will be a great day for us when the soul again mirrors nature as a place for nature. And when I say nature, you know, you understand, I'm not just talking about the outdoors and the mountains and the stream. Talking about one's own nature, our connections to the instinctual world. We have much too fierce a programming of our instinctual natures today in our lives. And that's part of the hero journey archetype, the cultural hero journey archetype, that is wearing us down. Okay. One more image right now, and then give us some things to work on, some statements that express the various images, and I think will help us with our individual work. This is a very short dialogue. This is the figure of a shepherd, a rather strange shepherd who has 100 eyes, right? Argus. Not Argos, the city, but A-R-G-U-S. So he's kind of a monstrous shepherd with 100 eyes. And apparently some of the myths say, accounts of the myth that he's engaged by Hera to guard Io. And Argus says, "Open your eyes, sleeping cow. Come on, open your eyes." Io opened wide her great dark eyes to stare at the terrifying shepherd. "Aha! So that proves it. I had to be sure." What is it that is proved? That you're Io, all right. That I've got the right white heifer. How can you tell? For I don't even know myself anymore. Goddess Hera gave me the clues, she said, "You'll know my priestess Io by her eyes. They are great dark orbs with a lost god in them. And they appear to trail a thread of light. Oh, my sorrow, for Hera, my queen goddess, who sits in her sacred house above my city, Argos, is lost to me." And she began to weep. He nudged her roughly. "There's no use in dripping tears down on your front hoofs. Who are you anyway, wearer of the bull robe? Don't you know? I slew the great wild bull that roamed Arcadia, and his hide is mine now. So I'm wearing it. Meet Argus Panoptes." That means 100 eyes. "That one, the man who is all eyes. I'm a good looker, you can depend on that. Now stand still for old Argus. A rope around my neck? Has it come to this? Oh, do leave me alone, I beg you. It's time you were tethered, you know. Hera's orders. There now. You're tied to the old olive tree. Your do-as-you-please days are over, girl, I tell you. And she sat down and wept under the gnarled olive tree. And she stays apart from the herd, and he sits a few yards from her, this kind of hoary, big figure with the eyes trained on her hour after hour, seeming to accuse her. And finally she says, if only I could hide, we don't know how much time has gone by, but if only I could hide from the 100 eyes of Argus, see how they fix me with guilt, accusing me. Oh, Argus, go away. I'm your guard appointed by here. I'm not going anywhere, so relax, girl. Besides, I know all about maidens like you. Oh, what can you know? You can't fool me, not old Argus. I know what you've gone and done. You have taken a man in the meadow. Hera believes this of me? She knows, girl. She despises you, fallen priestess. It's a lie against me. I've not taken a man in the meadow. You mean you deny that it happened in the meadow? No, it was truly the meadow, she said. See, gleefully, you admit you're guilty. No more priestess robes for you and incense and libations looking all innocent-like at the altar. You are going to face Hera's fury, I tell you. And then she swears an oath by the river Styx, which is a very powerful oath, that no mortal man has touched her, and confesses finally that a heavenly cloud descended upon her in the meadow. And she says of it, a strange and golden time was upon us, the time of the beginnings. A world was created, the world in which I now walk and have my being. Yeah, and you were created into a cow instead of a girl. You were duped, you know. Who was this fellow anyway? Io swears she will never tell because it is unspeakable. Yet Argus continues to harass her mercilessly until all of a sudden he guesses that her lover is Zeus. And then he says, no wonder Hera is in such a fury because she's lost her spouse to Io. And he speaks scornfully of Zeus's passion and faith and faithlessness. And points out that Hera's way is best, it's old in tradition, and it's strong. So he kind of stands with that old tradition, and but he's a very negative side, isn't he, of Hera? How do you feel, Argus, just pausing for that? Do you recognize this character? Have you met him? What would you say about him? What? What kind of? You're just something to be seen and assessed. Very critical self, yeah. Very critical aspect, yeah. Critical, judgmental aspect. An animus you can't escape from.
I was thinking how often there are these guests named artists who spread all out for the world.
Yes, that's right. Uh-huh. Yes. Yes. That's an interesting idea, aspect of it I hadn't thought of. That. Nothing is private or hidden. The very opposite from her process. Excuse me. Anything else? Yes, did it happen?
Yes. And it was a comment or question.
Yes. Yes. Right. It introduces doubt, and that's referred to later to.
She's a prisoner.
Absolutely. She is a prisoner, yes. What anything else you'd want to say about the tether? The function of the tether? Yeah. Keeps her from running away, yes. Keeps her in one spot. Is that good or bad? Is that... Certainly she's a prisoner, isn't she?
And in a place that she didn't choose.
And in a place she did not choose. This is the most choiceless thing that's really happened, probably. Can't be sure how much choice in some of the things, but this is really choiceless.
And yet she has to speak the truth of her experience in that other place. She's, she's held there. She has to make that oath.
Right. So you feel some consciousness comes through there. Yes, I think that's important then. Yes. However negative it feels to her, there is some important consciousness that comes out of it. Yes. And there is something else that she learns while she's there. About Hera, I think. Don't think it's probably occurred to her that Hera would be angry with her if she's been the favorite priestess. So there's a coming to terms with a dark reality here that's really important. Is there any value to be found in the ordinary tether that one knows in life? Can you think of where you are tethered? Can you think of any value to that?
Similar to a container in which you're contained within the length of the tether. So it has some value.
Holds you to something at hand in a limited way.
Is that where the choice comes in, though? You can fight against the tether, or you can use what's within the range of the tether.
Okay, she said the choice is to fight the tether or to accept it and stay within the circle of it. Actually, tether is a grounding device. Put a stake in, and then the rope. Actually, she has been tethered to the temple up to this point in her life. I don't know what the temple symbolizes to you, but it certainly has been her outer covenant up to now.
whatever is the outer work. Of course, it had an inner investment of some sort too, but it is an outer work. And that is very close to broken now. It has tethered her for some time. Any kind of a covenant or profession or work can be a kind of tether. And it has its positive aspect. Of course, at times it does rub the neck. One would rather frolic in the meadow. I need some of that too. But it does have that function. Oh, good.
But this has a feeling to it, sort of like that this is, she's been tethered all the way throughout the story, except for the moment with the plow. And, but this has a feeling like this is the worst and the last tether. I don't know if that's to be or not.
All right, you've got a good sense of things. Mm-hmm. I mean, a good nose for what's coming.
To nature, to
yeah. Yeah. She's tethered to the ground, to nature, which is different from being tethered in the traditional place of the temple. Yes.
At this moment in time, isn't she having to face up to a few things that she wouldn't normally if she kept grazing from pasture to pasture? Now she's got to stop, and here's this accusatory thing, and there's a lot of this. Oh, that's what happened. Oh, she's really mad at me. Oh,
uh-huh. Yes.
And as people have been pointing out, she's had to tell her story, and this is kind of like, yeah. An owning up to what's happened.
Yes.
Some important realizations and acceptance of her role.
Right.
As she thought she was innocent and passive.
Yes. That's right. There is much that's learned in this period, however long this period is, under Argus, under this absolutely shepherd with no compassion or nothing. I mean, it's a very dark, imprisoning time, but she does gain some really new insights and information that she's going to need to save herself for survival.
She will only be able to graze too. She'll only have food to eat within this, as far as the tether will allow.
Within that.
And it is a whole her world in a sense, in
yes.
that space.
Yes.
I mean, the dung will be, quote, you know, she won't be able to go all over the whole thing.
No. Very limited. Very limited. The crucial covenant, here the crucial covenant that is coming about has to do with Zeus's love and will. The crucial covenant requires that the animal in oneself be tethered. This covenant will not be lived entirely for one's pleasure, yet there will be joy in it, to be sure. It binds one in some important way, this intersection of this divine level or this archetypal level with the human level. The divine eros in the experience binds one too. You know, Aphrodite's spoken to that bond, hasn't she? She said, oh no, you're not going to be free. Anybody who's in love is bound. You're not going to. But she said it's a joyous joyous bondage. So this also, the divine eros binds one. One cannot now be free to do anything at any time, howsoever one pleases. One is chosen by the gods, and a covenant has developed quite naturally. Sounds a little Old Testament, doesn't it? one is really chosen by the God. It is not imposed upon one. Maybe you question that. Even so, when one is feeling negative about it all, it appears that an indifferent shepherd, Argus, has a rope about your neck. At the time that you feel most negative is when you experience Argus. Okay? But this is a way, the myth's way of portraying not just her victimization, but her experience. She experiences accusation. She experiences imprisonment. She experiences limitation and a loss of choice, which is a loss of choice. Yes. Yes, and you cannot hide from those, yeah. But it's just terribly exposed, just dreadfully exposed. Since this is the end of the scene here, I just want to read you this part, and then I will give those statements, I promise. The dusk comes over the meadow and under the olive tree, and the temple is seen in the distance, and Io stands with her head down, and Argus is a little way off, watching. And there comes over the rise of the hill, not from the direction of the city or the temple, but from the north, one supposes, a lively figure, stepping lively, with a three-cornered hat, which is the traveler's hat, a cloak over his shoulders, obviously a young shepherd, and very bright stride, and I don't have the first page. Okay. Here we are. Well, in any case, Hermes comes on the scene. And I think I did not bring the whole of the dialogue. Hermes comes upon the scene and addresses her and says, you know, no disguise would ever conceal you from my eyes, something to that effect. And he says, of course, because you are a bride of Zeus. And then he approaches... She complains about what she's gone through very elaborately. And he said, things are not going to change unless. And she said, unless. And Hermes said, unless Argus is given up. Hermes, I despise him, to be sure. Do you doubt that? Take him away, I implore you. Then, he said, you must quit looking with his eyes, for he fills you with complaints, misery, and judgments, and doubt. I see. Yet he means well, she adds. Ye gods, close your ears. She said, I must admit that some things he tells me really are true. You cannot now have two shepherds, Io. It is either Argus or else myself. You must make your choice quickly but well, for it is a choice you will have to live. Now, she has already recognized him as the great Hermes, who is a great shepherd and is guide of souls. Must I choose, she asked.
And that is the end of the tape. Copyright CGU Society, Seattle, and the speaker. All rights reserved. No copying, please.